Welcome to Midnight Donatello's Discussions on Creativity with Kate Morin. Today, Midnight Donatello's talks with Cassie Soliday, script coordinator on Disney's Puppy Dog Pals. We talk about career aspirations, women who inspire us, taking the leap of faith to get to that next level, and why she started her wonderful podcast, Ink and Paint Girls. You can find Cassie online on IMDb, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. The links are in our show notes at midnightdonatellos.com or anchor.fm/midnight-donatellos.
I'm Cassie Soliday. I'm currently a script coordinator on Disney Junior's Puppy Dog Pals, and I've done a little bit of freelance writing and hope to do more. I'm passionate about a lot of things. I'm passionate about people. I'm passionate about ideas. I have a podcast called Ink and Paint Girls, as well as another one called Jammy Spits of Jam. I like making things, and I like making things.
That's awesome. Yeah. Thank you so much for being here today, Cassie.
Thanks for having me.
So I wanted to talk about what do you do as a script coordinator?
As a script coordinator, I always leave things out whenever I tell anyone, and I'm like, God, it's not a lot. But then when I actually look at my job description, it is, because it's a lot of, as most production positions in animation and live action and probably anywhere, is you have a lot of spinning plates to keep track of. Mm-hmm. But as a script coordinator on my show, I proofread everything that comes out of the writing department and send it to network, get network notes from executives, and get it back to the writers. I'm the liaison between production, like the rest of production. Mm-hmm. I update the scripts at every stage. At V1 Animatic, V2 Shipping, Animation, V1 Lighting, and as broadcast scripts at the very end. So it matches picture every step of the way. Mm-hmm. And I also, the way our show is organized, I also go to records and prep for those and take circle notes whenever we have the voice actors doing their multiple takes of each line. Mm-hmm. So I'm kind of just there to make sure the spirit of the scripts, like, go from writing throughout the production pipeline. Yeah. Doesn't mean that things don't change, and some things are lost along the way, but ultimately, as a script coordinator, that's not my decision. You know, the showrunner, as you know, like, sees it all the way through to the end, along with many, many talented directors and artists. It's really cool to see what comes out at the other side of the collaboration. Absolutely. Yeah, so that's pretty much a general thing, like, of what I do.
Have you always wanted to be a script coordinator?
No, I didn't know that was a thing until I was in the industry, really. Some shows, like when I worked at Disney on a different show, One Floor Down from You, at that time, I did know that there were script coordinators and that they worked very closely with the writers, and that a lot of writers I had met, like at Nickelodeon, had started as script coordinators and got a few freelance scripts and eventually got to be staff writers. But Disney didn't have any script coordinators. Like, a few shows had writer's assistants or writer's apprentices, but not every show did, and that was very frustrating. It was like, no, why am I on the only show that doesn't? And of course, that's dramatic me talking. There's plenty of shows that have that, and there's plenty of shows that don't. But at Wild Canary, where they make Puppy Dog Pals, they actually did have script coordinators, and so when the 7D was wrapping up, I could either stay at Disney on another show or go to Wild Canary. And it wasn't for a script coordinator position, but basically what I was thinking is that at the end of one more year, because most seasons of episodic animation television takes about a year to make. Yeah. And that's pretty much the life of a production role on a show. So at the end of the next year, I could still be a production coordinator or I could be a script coordinator. Maybe, you know?
Yeah.
And I would rather have that maybe attached to it than not. Although it's so comfortable here at Disney. You know what I mean? That was hard.
No, it's always hard because it feels like, in some ways, like you're leaving your home.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's also, I try to look at it as you're off having another adventure. But you can still come back. You can come back, and before you know it, you'll be back here, but as a writer.
I hope so. That's the plan. That or a showrunner. Or eventually. Totally see that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. One day we both have shows, and then we'll commiserate over how miserable we are, but also how blessed we are. I feel like there's probably like that double side to every position you will ever have.
Absolutely. But that actually, you did touch on what I was going to ask you next, which was where do you see yourself? Like, what is your ultimate goal?
I want to create and run a show.
Awesome.
One thing I have to say about production, like, I've had good days and bad days in it, like I'm sure everyone has in their jobs, but I really love getting to see the overall pipeline of a production. You get to see script go into the hands of artists and directors, and something's added at every step of the way. You get to see it get designed. You get to see it all come together in animation and layout. And then when it goes into, like, for CG shows, goes into lighting, you get to see the color added. And it's just magical. And then you see the environments come alive, with, like, particles being made, like, dirt and clouds. And it's just so beautiful. And you don't get to see that when you're in one specific space.
Yes.
I felt like, for me, when I saw, like, designers and everyone who are in those positions are so good and they love what they do most of the time. Well, for me, because I have done freelance prop design, a very little bit. It wasn't a lot, to be very fair. But getting a list of things to design didn't speak to me. Mm-hmm. And, like, when I saw the designs in the final picture on TV, I didn't really feel anything.
Yeah.
And at a record on the 7D, Tom Ruger, the executive producer of that show, let me rewrite a final line on the episode. And I got to hear people like Billy West, Bradley D. Baker, Kevin Michael Richardson, all these amazing people say this one stupid line I wrote. And it was really stupid. And it was one line. It had like three words in it. And they said it. And like I just got really warm. Like I thought maybe I had something wrong with my heart. But it was just very warm. It was just like this warm flash. And I'm like, I think it's connected.
It's the quickening.
Yeah, it's like, this is it, you know? And, like, I had been writing before that, like, in, on, like, for theater and, like, in, like not improv, for sketch comedy and comedy shows and stuff like that, but never anything with such a big collaboration base and a huge platform like TV. So from that point, I was like, How do I write? How do I, like, I'm really going to go for this. Because at that point, I was also still thinking maybe art, even though I had those feelings. Oh. But this moment really solidified it for me, that I was like, no, I got to do this.
Wow. So walking it back, when you were in high school, what did you think you would do? Like, what did you think you would go to college for and ultimately be?
Well, actually, since I was five, I knew I wanted to be an animator.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So I was gung-ho the entire time.
Okay.
However, in high school, I was very much into music, so I did take a slight detour, but I always wanted to be an animator and on the side be a touring musician.
So, I love this.
Like, I wanted to do all of it and also illustrate children's books and write and, I wanted to have a family by 19. Like, it was crazy.
Wow.
I had huge plans, and I was like, I'm not going to live beyond 20, so I got to do it all before I'm 20.
Oh, that was my
stupid plan. The folly of youth, right? Like, it's so funny.
I still remember, like, 16-year-old me thinking, like, 25 was over the hill, you know? And she's like, oh, and then you get old, and your life is basically over.
Yeah, I just turned 30, you know, too long ago, and I'm like, there's more, you know? So I'm going through those feelings right now. But, yeah, I wanted to be an animator since I was five and went to college for hand-drawn animation. I took some CG because they're like, if you want to eat, you got to take CG. And I'm like, okay. So I did it. Yeah. I didn't like it. I like the quick satisfaction of drawing something by hand, where the tactileness of feeling the paper, feeling the pencil. And they told me in college that there wasn't hand-drawn work anymore. I didn't care. I was like, not for me. I'm going to go to California and I'm going to get a job as a as an assistant or an in-betweener, probably an in-betweener because, like, I wasn't that great, to be really honest. I work really hard, but I was not that great. And then I got out here and I was like, oh, they weren't joking. All those jobs are overseas.
Oh, wow.
But I did manage to do cleanup on a, like, on a short for a WB pitch or something. And, or it wasn't a pitch. I mean, it was cleanup. It was like a short they were making. And so I got to do that. It was okay. I would do it again just for the joy of hand-drawn animation.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I haven't done anything else like that. There's not a lot of work out here, and for what there is, there are plenty of people who used to do that as a job for, like, big studios like WB or Disney,
yeah.
And they get those jobs first, you know, like at Duck Studios, where they do a lot of commercials and, like, the animated, like, pieces of, The Diary of a Wimpy Boy or a Wimpy Kid.
Yeah, The Diary of a Wimpy Kid, yeah.
Yeah, so they did the animation in that show.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, so it seems like most of the 2D stuff they get to do, but it's not a lot of stuff, you know?
Yeah, which is a shame because there's such a charming, beautiful look to 2D. I don't want to see it go away.
Yeah, and I feel like there's more style exploration in 2D. I mean, we're seeing it in, you know, Big Hero 6, the series, and Rapunzel, you know?
Yes.
Like, it's crazy. And I think PenZero did this too. They could achieve so many different textures and interesting things to experiment with. I'm sure it was production nightmare getting it in on time, because I could only imagine all the creative problems you would overcome challenging like a software like that. But yeah.
Well, you can always bring 2D back with your project.
I would love that.
That would be awesome.
But also, I still want it to be cheap so that I get more seasons. I'm more practical now and kind of understand.
I think being on the production side kind of makes you that way.
Yeah, that's true.
Writing a story is like too many assets.
No. Yeah, it's like, do I want to create a show where characters travel all the way around the world and new locations and new characters have to be made every single week? Maybe not. Doesn't mean I won't, but
yeah,
you do have to think about those things and be practical about it, because I think. And I don't know, I've never been on the exec side of making the decision if a show gets another season, but I wonder if those things go into deciding that.
I just wanted to say that this is interesting, because basically we're recording two podcasts back to back, because we recorded your podcast. Mm-hmm.
You were a guest on my show.
And so we're having conversations on that podcast, and there are some that I wanted to, like, bring over to this one as well.
Yeah.
And one of the things that we had talked about on your podcast was you asked a great question regarding female showrunner, female writer that had an influence for me. And I couldn't tell you, in the sense that my favorite shows have strong female leads and strong female stories, but they were actually done by men. So I'm really interested in hearing from you, like, who were some of your influences?
Oh, God. It scares me. Who are some of my influences? I feel like I have so many. I'll just say who comes to mind the quickest, because I'm freaking out about this now. I have to say, Christina Reed is one of them. Mm-hmm. She's a producer. She was the producer of Feast and I think Big Hero 6. I could be wrong, but actually, I'm just going to, like, re-say that because I don't want to be wrong. But she was the producer on Feast, the short, and another feature, but Feast is the one that sticks with me. And while I was here at Disney, they have this great learning, portal on the employee website. And I loved listening to, like, talks and lectures that other creatives around the company would give, but, like, Nancy Cantor did a really great one too. But with Christina, it actually prompted me to reach out to her. Like, I emailed her and met with her. But basically, in this talk, she was sharing how on Feast they were able to really organically make that short. And it basically started with one of the, I believe he was an artist, taking pictures of his food every single day for like 6 months or something.
Yeah.
And they realized that it told a story. Like, there were days where he was really stressed out, didn't really have enough time for himself, and he'd eat really crappy. And then there were other days where, like, or other weeks where he was taking really good care of himself, and he had very green and colorful meals.
Oh my
and
gosh.
It also related to what he was going through personally,
yeah.
which is what that short's all about, although it is through the dog's perspective, which is really cute, too.
Yeah.
But with such an organic process, I mean, and especially in TV, we don't get that. You know,
yes.
we have very... very difficult deadlines sometimes, and sometimes artists and creatives have to just make a decision that they're not really fond of, you know, and like their values get kind of shut out the door sometimes, you know, and it's really disappointing, and I'm sure it's really frustrating for them. It's frustrating to see that happen where you're like, oh, I know you wish you had another week on this, I'm so sorry, and you can't do anything for them. Of course, it's a job, you have to move on, you know, you can't dwell on these things, but with the short, when they'd when they would have like any trouble or any like story issues, they would push out the schedule a little bit and kind of start over or like brainstorm ways to fix things. And I'm summarizing very, very crudely, but it was just very inspiring to hear a producer be open to such a fluid, organic process.
Yeah.
And it felt like, at least in my experience, hearing someone kind of innovate a new frontier in a way, because mm-hmm. she was going against, like, oh, time is money. You know, like, it was like, do you need more time to tell a very intimate story? Let's do it. You know what I mean?
That's amazing.
And so she believed in it, and she was just very inspiring, just the way she spoke about it. And it didn't feel personal. Like, wait. Like, it was very personal to her, but it also felt not personal.
Yeah.
Just because she was there to aid the process, to kind of oil the wheel mm-hmm. and make space for people. And I think that's where I first learned that word is to make space, you know, for
Which
your
is
creatives.
A terrific concept.
Yeah. So she was creatively producing, and I thought that was amazing. So I would say her. And I've never worked with Lauren Faust. This was one mm-hmm. of your answers.
Yes.
I've never worked with her, but I do love how strong, like, she is as a person, because she seems, just through stories I've heard, to, like, really go through a lot, you know, in her mm-hmm. career, and she's still out there creating and kicking butt, and I've heard that she's one of the few people that people have worked with who actually knows what they want and can verbalize any revisions that you need to do, because sometimes people are like, I don't like it, but they don't know what to tell you.
Exactly.
And apparently she's really good at it. People I know... I should say, Aminder Dhaliwal, and I might be saying her last name wrong, but she's amazing. She's a director here at Disney
uh-huh.
on the Owl House now. Katie Rice, amazing. There's like all these women I know who should be showrunners, and they're pitching their little hearts out and directing and everything, and one day they will. But there's just so many fresh voices and ideas, and they're freaking hilarious women. Ashlyn Anstey is amazing. I could go on, and I probably should. Cheyenne Curtis is hilarious. I would love to see she designed the main characters for Star vs. the Forces of Evil.
Mm-hmm.
So she's designed characters for shows. I was going to say, I want to see her characters in the show, but I have, kind of, you know. But yeah, there's a lot of really talented women out there, but they're not necessarily showrunners yet.
Yeah. And we definitely need more female showrunners.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can't wait.
Me too. And I can't wait till you get a show, too.
I can't wait till you get a show.
Thanks.
It's going to be awesome.
We have shows in our heart right now.
And I'll be your number one fan.
I'll be yours. I feel like you're everyone's number one fan already, though, which is nice. You're not waiting till they're in their upper positions of their career. You're like, I'm a fan of you now.
Yeah, I'm like, I'm in on the ground floor. I'm the OG number one fan.
Ooh,
yeah.
I like that.
Like, I knew you were hot and amazing before the world. So it's like, I'm right there. I'm right there. Tastemaker.
I love that. I love that.
I also, we were... we were talking about how you got started with your podcast and how it was kind of similar to like why I started this podcast.
Yes.
So I'd love to talk with you about, you know, the process of how did you start your podcast?
Yeah. Well, Ink and Paint Girls is a podcast where I speak with other women working in animation, and we discuss their careers and how they got in, how they continue to stay in, because you don't just make it once. You have to continue hustling to continue to make it.
Yeah.
Because these jobs are fleeting and they do have end dates pretty consistently. Mm-hmm. I'm told at a certain point it can get smoother, but it's still sometimes difficult to continue to getting work. But the start of the whole podcast was when I was in college. I had a history of animation class. I didn't do anything for a while on this idea, but I just noticed in this history of animation class that there were two women mentioned and, like, so many men mentioned, you know.
Wow.
I think it was Lillian Friedman, who was the first known animator in a studio.
Mm-hmm.
I believe it was Walter Lantz's studio in New York, but she was the first female animator. And then Mary Blair. And most of the general public know Mary Blair or
right.
have at least seen her work. It's beautiful. They yeah. both deserve they both deserve to be in that history of animation class, of course.
Yeah.
But there's so many other unsung women in the history of animation,
mm-hmm.
but you only hear those few stories. And obviously the Ink and Paint Girls, I mean, they weren't mentioned in the class. They it's mentioned in kind of like this was a department, you know?
Yeah.
But a lot of the time, and there's this, like, this letter online that kind of circulated where, like, if a woman applied with her portfolio to the Disney studio,
mm-hmm.
they would get a letter back from one of Walt's secretaries, obviously, like, signing for him and everything, that usually women go straight to Ink and Paint because
uh-huh.
it's women's work. Just because they have a delicate hand, which is a compliment, you know, it is a compliment.
Yeah.
And the beautiful thing about it as well is that you see their lines and, you know, their brushstrokes mm-hmm. on the screen. Animators seldom see their work on the screen, which is why in, like, Jungle Book and Fox and the Hound, you actually see their really rough, or no, maybe Fox and the Hound, but definitely, like, 101 Dalmatians when they were doing mm-hmm. the Xerox, which a ton of inkers lost their jobs over, obviously, because then they didn't need inkers. But you got to actually see their lines in there.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So anyways, interesting point. Not really related, but I just had to throw it out there. But, you know, women were typically in those ink and painter roles.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't often get opportunities to be animators across the board. But at Disney, particularly, the reason they weren't given animation opportunities was that, oh, we would train you. And then you'll get married and go have a baby, and then you won't return to work. So it's like a lost resource,
oh my goodness.
You know, or a waste of resources for us to train you, which is a bummer, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But back in the day, that was kind of expected of women, you know,
yeah.
to settle down and be a stay-at-home mother and stuff. Obviously, times have changed, and women, you know, when Ink and Paint was no longer there, they evolved into other positions,
mm-hmm.
You know, across different places, but they finally got into animation and stuff. Oh my god, I'm so sorry. This is a long
Don't be sorry. I love this.
Okay. But it's just really inspiring that a lot of women who really, really wanted to be animators, like, finally got there. You know
yeah.
what I mean? And it took a lot of time. But the podcast grew out of not seeing enough women,
mm-hmm.
like, out there. I feel like sometimes as women, sometimes, not always, we don't like talking about ourselves.
Yeah.
So, and at the time I didn't know how many women were actually in the industry. And now that I'm here, I'm like, oh, thank God. But it's
yeah.
nice to get them away from their desks for like a minute to kind of talk about their experiences.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, there's that saying that women have to work twice as hard to
yep.
accomplish what a man does. So, I mean, they're all working their asses off and don't really get out there and like push themselves like most guys tend
mm-hmm.
to do. All the superstars we hear from usually are male.
Yeah.
So I wanted to create the podcast to, you know, find those women, share what they have to give to, like, the younger generation and just to others. Like,
yeah.
I love hearing from everyone. It feels like mentorship, and you had mentioned that's why you want to do your podcast.
Yeah.
And if I'm going to try to weasel mentorship out of these amazing people, I want to share it with other people as well, because that's all I can give, right? You know, and me in college wish this existed. exactly. at that time. Yeah. But it did take some time to get it started because I was like, do I want to do a gender-focused podcast? And it's not that we're angry feminists on the podcast or anything. We do talk about representation.
Yeah.
Because I think it's important to just talk about it. Mm-hmm. It helps if you're having those feelings and just hearing professionals talk about it. But we mostly focus on what they've done in their career mm-hmm. and just their thoughts and philosophies. And I feel like that's helpful as someone trying to, you know, accomplish and achieve some sort of success in the same industry. Like, yeah. we talk shop a lot. I try not to do too much inspiration. Like, I try to make it very tangible. Mm-hmm. Because that's what I need to hear, you know?
Yeah.
Because a lot of feelings come up in your job and, like, the office politics. Sometimes you're like, how do you deal with that, you know? And
oh, yes.
I try to be fairly blunt, you know?
Yeah.
And also make sure that these women are shown in, like a full view of a life. Because a lot of people just want to see you as a, like, oh, you just... like, do background design. You're just pumping them out. You don't, like, you're here all the time. Like, no,
right.
we should have lives because it'll make our art fuller. So I try to ask questions where you kind of give a full view,
yeah.
you know? Because, like, I want to learn how to manage my life better and also Absolutely. Be productive and creative. So, yeah, it grew out of all those things.
That's wonderful. But, and also, just to point out, like, something that I think we take for granted and forget is that women being playing a bigger role in animation is a fairly recent thing. And I think that we take it for granted, you know, in general, or the general we, that, you know, oh, women are in the industry and women can do, you know, whatever they want. And it's like, no, this is still very, very recent. And the group Women in Animation, the fact that their goal is still to get 50-50, you know, it's, we're going to get there, but mm-hmm. the fact that we're not there and animation has been around all this time, I think that's important that we know, we recognize that.
Yeah. And then on top of that, I mean, there's more than two genders too,
yes.
you know, like
yes.
we have LGBTQI and non-binary,
mm-hmm.
And we need a variety of voices, you know, it'll make the stories we tell so much.
Yeah.
More inclusive and fresh and exciting, you
and
know?
Everybody wants to feel like they're not alone, like they can see a version of themselves on television or on a movie screen, and they have somebody that they can identify with, and they feel like they're seen, and in it just by seeing that representation of yourself, you feel like you're okay. It helps you be a part of the bigger picture.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly I felt like that when I was growing up. I was one of the only Kappa kids. I didn't know anybody else who was mixed. And it was very difficult for me because I didn't see anyone on television or in movies that looked like me. I didn't have anyone in my schools who were like me. And it was a while before I met other people who were also mixed. So I thought that I always felt kind of like an outsider. And just seeing, I still remember meeting the first other, like, Hapa person in college, and I was so excited. I was just like, oh my gosh, tell me about yourself, where have you been? You know?
Yeah.
And it just made, like, the biggest difference. And then now, of course, like, I meet so many more, and it feels normal, and just, like, I wish I had that as a kid. So definitely for myself, I really strive to try to make sure that I'm building a world that includes more than excludes. I want everyone to play a part.
Yeah, and it creates compassion for those who aren't directly related to
yeah.
that character.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, it's not the same at all. I'm not comparing, but I felt like an outcast growing up as well, just because of my red hair and freckles. Like, I have, like, a million
oh.
freckles, and, like, everyone
yeah.
else had beautiful freaking porcelain skin, and I'm like, what's wrong with me? So, not seeing characters with, like, a million freckles or red
yeah.
hair on TV was also, like, I thought something was wrong with me consistently, you know?
Oh.
And I'm white, Caucasian, like, I shouldn't be complaining, but it was a feeling I had, you know?
Yeah. No, my dad's side of the family, my dad is Irish, so my dad's side of the family is primarily redheaded with freckles. I had a lot of freckles as a kid, and now it's like I basically have to stay out of the sun for the most part because I have this sun sensitivity for sure. And also, like, even though I don't have blue eyes, but I have like super light sensitivity for my eyes as well. But my dad would get like the tons of freckles. Like, he would freckle and then burn. So like every time we went to like a Dodgers baseball game or something, come back home, and he'd have all these crazy new freckles all over his arms. And when he'd fall asleep watching the TV, I would start connecting the dots. He would wake up.
I understand this. I relate because I did the same thing.
Oh, that was terrible. I shouldn't do that.
Anytime I see someone else with red hair and freckles, kind of like what you said, I always kind of like stare at them because I'm like, did you get made fun of as a kid too? Like, I just kind of want to relate, but also like some people didn't. So, but. It's okay.
Yeah, but it's, like, nice to have that, you know, hey, there's somebody else like me. So it's okay. It makes you feel better. It's like,
yeah, it really does. And as a kid, when you're, like, your only goal is to fit in.
Yes.
Like, anything that makes you stand out is, like, damn it. But, of course, as an adult, you're like, how do I stand out? Which is an interesting, like, it's like, I don't remember when that flip happened. But when I think about it now, I'm like, oh, yeah, I really wanted to fit in and be invisible. And now I'm like, someone notice me, please.
Yeah, it's like, give me this opportunity. I'm here. Here's my hand.
Hello, I've been working really hard.
I did want to discuss some of your other projects too, because in addition to the podcast, you have a few other projects in the works.
I do. I actually have another podcast.
Yes.
But
please.
It's on hiatus at the moment because we decided to redo how we're publishing our stuff, because we were like one episode a month show. But now we're going to do seasons. And basically, me and my podcast partner, I don't know, co-host, me and my co-host, okay. We write stories, but we dare each other to write based on a theme. And then the next time we meet, we kind of intro like, oh, remember you dared me to write about the big storm, and I did. So now I'm going to read my story. And then like we record it live time. And then afterwards, whoever didn't write the story asked questions about what it took to write it. And all of these stories are draft ones,
yeah.
You know, because at the end of the day, everyone's so busy and we all have our goals that we're trying to like achieve daily. And like writing for yourself is always at the bottom of the list. So, and the other thing is we write 10-minute stories. So that's about 3 to 4 pages.
Okay.
Cause it's about 10 minutes when you read it out loud. And, you know, when we're done with these episodes, we have like 5 to 7 stories written per season, you know, and I already have 2 that I would like to turn into short films. So I might not do anything with them anytime soon, but that's still like, I'm like having kind of like a bin of ideas that I can go back to that are kind of like short story draft ones that I can like go back to. So, and also we like this new version of the podcast that it's going to be releasing soon, because we get to talk about how did you get from the big storm to like Death Eaters at the door kind of thing. Like, how did that happen? Cause sometimes you just like base it on themes and sometimes you rely heavily on it. Like the big storm is about a big storm, or it's like an internal storm. Like how do you take that idea and like move it forward? You know, and sometimes, quite often in the writer's room on these shows, you have to do the same thing. Like, you just, like, what are we going to tell? We're on the 4th season. We have done almost every type of story. What are we going to, how are we going to keep it fresh? And then you just throw a bunch of bad ideas out and you take the spirit of some and you find something good. You know, it's like digging for gold. That's why we do that one. It'll be relaunching later in September.
Okay.
It'd be exciting. But other projects, I have so many, like, half-baked ideas that I'm like, which one should I do next? And like I've told you, I've written a short film called Bitchwood that I want to make. I want to make it so bad. It's about 4 minutes, 3 to 4 minutes, and mm-hmm. I'm excited to do that. And I was struggling to whether I wanted to do a comic next or mm-hmm. short film, but you've kind of made the decision for me because you're so smart and logical. If you ever have any issues, ask Kate. She'll put it into perspective for you. Because I'm like, which wall should I climb? And you're like, it's not a wall. Just do both. And I'm like, okay, you're right. So thank you. Yeah, totally. Yeah. And since the film will be a collaboration, as you said, like, mm-hmm. I'll do my part. And then the people who want to help me would do the rest. Mm-hmm. And I'll be there, obviously, to help. But, yeah, that's what collaboration's good for.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I'm sure I'm missing something. But I think that's it. Oh, my comics.
Yeah.
I also do diary comics. Mm-hmm. Last year I did one every day of the year. I'm still trying to finish it. Still trying to finish it, though. Because every day of the year I did do, like, at least a crude sketch, if not wrote down, like, what each panel would be. Because it was four-panel comics for the most part. And it was either how I was feeling that day, what was going through my head, or something wonderful or terrible that happened during the day. Mm-hmm. And I've been doing these kind of comics since 2013 off and on. But last year I was like, I'm going to do a whole year. And I did it. Now I'm just cleaning it up so I can, like, print them into little zines.
Oh, nice.
Because I would love to do, like, a whole book all for 2017.
Yeah.
But, of course, diary comics are kind of, like, they have this, like, autobio comics in general, just, like, where people just share their lives in mm-hmm. comics. Like, it could be very, it could be really wonderful, or it can be really, like, do I have to finish this? It has a reputation for being very, like, inside, I guess.
Okay.
You know, like, not everyone... Well, I feel like a lot of people are like, so what makes you so great that you feel like you have to make a comic about yourself? But I, like, get very depressed quite often, mm-hmm. and I get burnt out pretty quick. But it's also because I try to do too much at once, and I give and give and give, and I don't really take care of myself sometimes. Mm-hmm. So... and I'm far away from my family. I rarely get to see them, maybe once every 3 years, you know?
Oh, wow.
And just, like, life, like, what are we doing here? Like, you have those, like, life thoughts sometimes. Or maybe you don't, and that's good for you. I wish I would. Tell me your secrets, because I think about it way too much. I'm like, what's the point? Am I using my life well? How could I be doing more? How can I stop the world from dying? You know, like, all the questions. And so it was kind of helpful as... in looking back, like, at my week or my month and being like, mm-hmm. you know what, my life's not that bad. You know, there's some really beautiful moments, and I'm glad I'm putting them down on paper. And it was actually quite a nice, like, self, like, care thing that I could do.
Yeah.
And people seem to like them when I post them, which is really nice. And I'm also, a lot of my comics are of my husband, because he says stupid and silly things all the time, and I just... And I love drawing his beard. That's probably, like, the funnest thing. But it's also, like, you know, documenting our life together.
Yeah.
And, like, stupid shit we do, bad times and good times. And that's really cool. I don't know. I think there's nothing better than seeing a life happen, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that's why I like podcasting so much and interviewing people, is because you get to see what, you get to hear the inside of what they went through. Because you can talk to people, like you and I could probably talk about Lauren Faust for, like, an hour at least, but we don't know what it's like, and we won't know until we interview her, because she's probably definitely on both of our lists. But to talk to someone and see, like, firsthand, like, what they went through and how they kind of processed everything is very invaluable, you know? So.
And, you know, for me, it's like, I don't ever look at anyone's project like, oh, but especially, like, the autobiographical ones. It's like, oh, what makes you so great that you, you know. It's like, for me, I always, I love the autobiographicals because I feel like they're sharing something that's very personal and very intimate with the world. And I feel like it's a privilege to get that peek, you know. And then I always love seeing how other people do things. Like, what is your approach to life? What is your approach to this? And, you know, how do you do that? So, like, for me, those comics are, like, I love them. I tend to love them.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I love the ones that you shared. I thought they were very funny and cute. And, Yeah, I love them.
Yeah. I will admit that there's quite a few where I'm face down on the floor being sad. So there's a lot of sad ones, but I only take up one panel. I don't waste your time with four. I don't know. Through doing these comics, I think I've found a lot of self-worth as well. Because, like, yeah. I feel like we give so much away to other people to validate us. Mm-hmm. And it's, like, it's a way of acknowledging that I have feelings and that's okay. Yeah. And in processing it, like, writing it down and drawing it, you're just kind of taking the time to allow yourself to have those and be like, okay, I've had this. Mm-hmm. I can think about why I'm sad or why I'm so happy. Because if you're so happy, like, how can you get that tomorrow, you know? Yeah. And it's you taking, like, a conscious and intentional 20 minutes to, like, put it on paper, you know? It's mm-hmm. like journaling. I mean, they're journal comics, right?
Yeah,
so absolutely. I think it's very valuable, especially, like, after college when you're, like, where's my job? I thought I was supposed to be handed a job. Where's my husband? I thought I was going to be handed a number. Where is my husband and my job? You know, and then you're like, oh, it's all chaos after college. There's until you get a job and then there's like a hierarchy again. But
it's like, I have this piece of paper. This is my ticket. It's a piece of paper saying I owe this much. Oh, okay.
Yeah, I'm still paying my student loan. So I'm really jealous you went to, you know, Santa Monica College and don't have any debt anymore.
It was, I'm really happy that I went that route.
So, yeah, I mean, that's the goal, right? And there was a point, and I think it was in college, where I started thinking about how selfish art is. Like, people just making things because they want to make things. Mm-hmm. And it seemed kind of, because I want to do good in the world. Like, that's my main thing beyond everything. Like, I've always wanted to be an animator or work in animation, tell stories, write. You know, I wrote from a young age as well. I forgot to mention that. But it felt selfish. And I was like, I should probably be a nun because, you know, stereotype, that was how you do good in the world. And then I wanted to be Oprah because she was doing more good than all the nuns I didn't know. So.
I went to Catholic school. I definitely would have chosen Oprah.
Yeah. Good. Younger me's like, I knew it. But something that I've realized in the past years, especially getting to work in the industry, scratch that. I think it was when I worked at Disneyland as a sketch artist in uh-huh. Disney California Adventure, when I realized that it isn't selfish, because, like, I got to draw, like, any character that anyone wanted, and they got to pick the colors, and they got to pick if there was any writing on it. That, like, they're very touristy gifts, to be yeah. quite honest, and we got the opportunity to design new ones, but pretty much the bulk of our job was copying all of these things and trying to make them look new and fresh, because there's like over 500 freaking Disney characters. Like, we're not going to remember them all and yeah. be able to draw them quickly. So it kind of looked like we were tracing. I'm doing that in quotes. But we had very artistic skills and could make them look freehand, and we tried to bring in, like, the animation principles, where we did the shapes underneath so you could see how the character was built. And it was just like character design class, like, all day, and it was amazing. But my point is that people would come up and look at these characters and be like, oh, look, it's Dad. Like, this character reminds me of Dad so much. Let's get this for him. Or girls all the time would be like, oh, it's Tinkerbell, it's me. And, like, at a point, it's like, okay. But it's also so freaking precious. Or there's movies where it's their favorite movie because it was the first one they saw with their grandma. Or, you know, there's all these beautiful stories that come out of particularly the Disney films. Yeah. But also, I always were at Disneyland. But, like, many films in general, all these stories, like, people connect with them, like you were saying earlier. Yeah. They see themselves in these characters, or they see part of their story. And I think that's what's so much fun about watching a movie, is, like, who do I connect with? Like, mm-hmm. what am I going to learn about myself by seeing it happen on screen through these other characters?
Yeah.
And that's not selfish, mm-mm. you know? And at one point in college, I was like, it's escapism. Like, people are going to have to return to their shitty life anyways. What's the point? But that's the point, you know? It's to put hope into the world. Absolutely. Or take them on a little ride. Because there is escapism out there, of course. Mm-hmm. Disneyland's a good example. But I don't think it's selfish anymore.
Since you do have all of these other projects that you are working on, your personal projects, and I know that being a script coordinator is really busy, how do you manage the balance between the two worlds? And do you ever find that, like, the work that you do for your day job ends up kind of burning out your creativity for your personal projects at all? Like, is there ever an effect between the two? Or does it stay pretty separate?
That's a good question. I mean, there's definitely, like, ebbs and flows. And I'm not always super productive. And it probably is related to work. If I'm having a really busy season at work, typically that entails me staying late or coming in early sometimes. It really depends on what it is. But I usually get home and I'm just like, I'm tired. I want to go to bed. Or I just want to not think about anything, especially depending on how much, I don't want to say politics, because it's not that, like, I've worked in very heavily, like, political atmospheres at work, but sometimes there are disagreements, and you're just like, someone make a decision, you know?
Yeah.
And it takes a toll on you, because you want to suggest things, but you're, like, I'm going to put in quotes, you're just a coordinator, you know? They have to make their own decisions, and you just have to support the creative process, right? Or it's just a lot of, and again, in quotes, menial tasks that are super important. But obviously, when you want to do something else, it kind of can feel menial sometimes. But again, it's all important. I understand all of this. You just have those feelings sometimes. But I've also noticed, I have noticed that when I am creating my own stuff on the side, I feel more fulfilled at work. And then I'm actually a better collaborator and supporter of others. Because when you're not doing your own thing as a creative person, it's like you're kind of denying yourself that outlet, you know? And it's not that your voice isn't heard at work, but you just know that other people trump you, like, consistently. You know what I mean? At the end of the day, it's just not yours, you know? Like, even the people running the show, it's not theirs at the end of the day. It's Disney's, you know? It's Disney's at the end of the day. It's ours too. You know, it's like one of those weird like gray areas where it's like, it's everyone's, but it's not truly yours. So to have something that's truly yours, where it's just you making the decisions, you actually like working out all the problems and building this thing from scratch. And although I feel better during those times, it is really difficult to like pull yourself out of a rut to go and make something. So I've kind of like, I've tried to notice these things and these patterns that I get into. I usually hit it really hard for like 3 weeks where I'm like super, super productive. But then I burn out for like 3 weeks and then I don't do anything. And it differs with how work's going and stuff. But things that I try to do is, like for one, on my desk I turn the lamp on when I get home, because I'm like, this signals to my future brain here in like an hour that I want to sit down and write, or I want to draw, or I just want to do something creative at my desk. And so an hour later after I've had dinner, I see that light and I'm like, oh yeah, I was going to do that. And then I sit down and I'm like 10 minutes at least, and usually I end up sitting there a lot longer. And I learned this from an animator at Pixar, because this is what he does as well. Kind of process from Eric Ely. He's an animator at Pixar. This is what he does for his personal project, which is actually not, it's not related to animation. He does like these really cool, anyways, he has a passion project of his, and that's kind of how him and his wife kind of force him to work on things, is that you don't have to, but you could just do 10 minutes, you know, and it's worked out, and she supported him in his goals and reminds him. And when Matt's around, my husband, he's like, just do 10 minutes, you know, and it works for us too. And it's really nice when you have someone to remind you that you only have to do 10 minutes, because everyone else is going to be so much sweeter to you than you are, so much sweeter to you than you will be to yourself. So that's one thing I've started to do. And I also wake up earlier, like on days when I want to write. I write better in the morning for some reason.
Because
otherwise, like 11 o'clock to 4 a.m. is also really good writing time for me. But obviously, I'm a mess the next day at work, so I can't do that anymore. I'm not 22 anymore. I need more sleep. But probably realistically, I've heard scientifically, you need less sleep as you get older.
I
but I'm not. So tired. Yeah. I don't know. I need my sleep.
I don't think we're there yet. I think we mean like people that are much, much older. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm going to sleep either way. I'm done listening to science. Just kidding. Science is great. We should support it.
Oh, yes. Now more than ever. Yeah. We definitely need science.
Definitely.
Yeah, this is a question we can edit out if it makes you uncomfortable.
Cool.
But we discussed how I have social anxiety, and I find that my social anxiety does inform a lot of my projects and some of the topics that I'll handle, because a lot of times I will start, basically a lot of my projects deal with taking out my monsters and playing with them so that they're not scary to me anymore, and just kind of like dealing with processing through stuff. Do you ever find that like depression or anxiety informs your projects, and that they help you work through things by working them out in your project?
I feel like with the comics, I can put my anxiety there and usually make it funny. But manifesting in different areas, I can write very neurotic and crazy characters pretty well, and I put that into them. I'm sorry, what was the question again? I'm sorry, I got meandering. I got in my head. I'm having an anxiety attack. Feel free to listen so you know it's real. What's the question again?
The question is, like, if depression and anxiety have informed, like, the type of projects that you'll you create, and if those projects have helped you work through depression and anxiety.
Yeah. Funny enough, the pilot that I've been writing for the last year off and on, it was actually pretty depressing, the first draft. It was kind of the main character. My feedback was, she's annoying and sad. And I was like, okay. Because that was kind of my childhood, where I was alone a lot and I was bored and I was just kind of like, no one understands me. And I was kind of sad. And I was trying, and I had a goal for this because I understood that she was not the most pleasant character. But I wanted to establish the dreary reality world so that when we got into the fantasy world, it was a clear separation.
Yeah.
But obviously in your pilot, you need to have that norm and then show what the change would be. And I only had a glimpse of the change at the very end. It was like supposed to be a teaser, and then you'd see the fantasy world in the second episode because it's an 11-minute pilot.
Okay.
So obviously I need to do a huge revision and condense these things. But it was very interesting to get that note. And I also recognize that we don't have a lot of females not being like super happy, peppy, and pretty, you know. We do have some, but usually that's the female character we get.
Yeah.
And I really wanted to have a transition from emotions, because it's supposed to be a lot about emotions throughout the series that I'd like to pitch. But I realized when I got the first round of notes, because I have like, I try to give each script out to like at least three people, and I try to gear what people are good at so that I get, you know, notes. Like if they have, like if they're used to this audience that the target is for, here, read this, tell me what you think. Or if you're a fantasy writer, like, what do you think? Or like if I had a preschool spec, I'd give it to a preschool writer to get, you know, her feedback on that, because she's established in preschool. So I try to do that. So with this one, I was just like, wow, she's, you know, after seeing it through other people's eyes, I was like, wow, maybe I put too much of my childhood depression into this character. So, and it's not funny. So I have to do a punch up for sure. I did one pass already and it's a lot funnier, but I apparently have to do another one. So it's going to be great. It's going to be fine. Yeah. It's just, you have to go through that process. But yeah, I do think that having anxiety and depression does come out in my work. Like when I improvise, I do very neurotic characters because I'm like scared shitless up there. And I'm like, I gotta get it out. You know, and then later on in the show, my characters get a lot more sane. So, but yeah, I would say yes.
Working with depression and anxiety, do you find that that makes it harder sometimes to have your balance of, you know, like, between your day work and your personal work? Like, do you ever feel like it makes it more challenging.
I think,
like, for myself, I find that the hardest thing for me is to not ruminate. I am the worst. I will, like, if something happened and, you know, like somebody said something and it really hurt my feelings, it's hard for me to not, like, keep taking it out and chewing on it. And it's almost like when you have, like, a cut on the roof of your mouth, mm-hmm. and you're just like, you know, you should just leave it alone.
But you keep touching it. Yeah.
So I'm just like, and then I find that it'll, if I don't get myself off that track, it'll keep me from being productive in anything else. Like, I get home and I'm still stuck in that loop, and I can't get into the groove of doing my own thing. And it gets frustrating for me because then, you know, your time at home is so limited already. Mm-hmm. It's just like, I didn't, you know, I lost a whole day of productivity. So,
yeah. That is very frustrating. And, I get derailed by people's comments or, you know, them projecting their own shit on you. Mm-hmm. I've gotten a lot better with age on moving on, but some things just stick with you, you know, especially if someone close to you says something, because unfortunately people you care about can also hurt your feelings, and typically they mean well, but sometimes they just don't check what they say. I'm sure I've done this to someone, one of my friends, and if you're listening, I'm sorry if I did that. I never meant to, and I'm sure you never meant to as well, but it happens, right? Those are hard to get over. I think one of my methods of trying to get over things, at least from people that aren't close to me, because I try to talk it out instead of feeling crappy and be like, hey, you know, that wasn't cool. It made me feel this way. And I also, you may have noticed in the entire time knowing me, I use the word feel typically, or like, I feel like, because no one can really challenge your feelings, right? That's like so personal. So I feel like people, sometimes, but I feel like most people take that as a clue to, like, kind of be cautious and listen more when you're talking about your feelings. Because interestingly enough, I mean, at least I've run into a lot of people who can't verbalize their feelings as well. And that's one thing I love focusing on in my writing is emotions. Because when I was a kid, I was told to smile, be happy. Why are you sad? You have no reason to be sad. And okay, sure, in the big picture, probably not, but I was still sad sometimes. And you can have those feelings, or like, stop crying, why are you crying? Like, it's just a pencil, you broke it. No, and that's silly, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Like, you're supposed to have feelings. Like, you wouldn't have feelings if you weren't meant to have feelings. So as an adult, I try to just let it happen. Which is exhausting to have feelings, right? It is. Like redheads have a stereotype of being quick to anger or, and I don't really get mad, but when I get mad, I get really, you know what I mean? And usually I cry first before I let it get to that point. And I've never let it get to that point until like probably late 20s because I was like, I can't be mad. I have to be happy. And then I would just like cry because I don't want to be mean to anyone. But I'm kind of cool with being a bitch sometimes now. And I try not to be a bitch to anyone. I just like, it's like a mantra, right? When you're feeling really crappy, just be like, no, be a bitch. Don't care. Don't care. You know? So it's like me being like, be a bitch. Don't care. Don't care. So that's one of my methods of trying to like get over crappy things.
Thank you.
I'm trying to reclaim that word, so.
Yeah. No, I like it because, I think as women, we have other people, like the outside world, constantly telling us what we can and can't do, what we can and can't feel, you know, how we should behave at any given moment. It's like, what's the matter, honey? Smile, you know, stuff like that. It's like, oh, you don't want to talk to me? You know, and it's just like, you know what? It's okay for me to be over here by myself with my earphones on and not have to interact with the world.
Yeah.
And be okay with that. Or, you know, if I'm having a bad day, it's okay to be sad. For me, the thing that happens with me is if I get mad, if I get really angry, I cry first, you know?
Yeah.
But then, like, I get so angry that I'm crying, You know, yeah. I'm like, I don't want to be crying right now. I want to punch something right now.
Yeah.
You know, and then I feel like the tears are betraying me, like they're making me look weak or something.
Mm-hmm. Totally. Crying is not weak.
It isn't.
Unfortunately, I've cried at my desk quite a few times, just because sometimes you get disappointed or you get sad over personal issues that you try not to bring into work. Because, like for instance, I had a sickness in my family earlier this year, and I was just, crying at my desk a lot. But I don't know if anyone noticed, but if you're listening to this podcast, I'm sorry if I distracted you from storyboarding. Yeah.
Sorry, I didn't know.
It's okay. Yeah.
No, but, that does highlight, though, that, sometimes it's just, as much as we try to separate, our personal lives from our work lives, we're one person, and they're both our lives, and so there's going to be, crossover.
Mm-hmm.
And so when something hard is going on in the personal life, it does come over. It does, you know?
Yeah. I believe that work-life balance, I won't say it's a lie. I think there is a balance to be had, but it's going to go back and forth. Sometimes you'll have more of a life, and sometimes you'll need to have a crunch time at work. I mean, it happens, and I think at least the productions I've been on have been so understanding. Be like, oh, I worked late yesterday. Could I maybe leave an hour or two earlier today to make up for that? Like, there's a lot of balancing that happens in just discussing, but you have to be able to ask for those things.
Yeah.
Or if you need to take 2 hours to go to the doctor, you know, because it's hard to get to the doctor, and it's hard to ask for time off to, you know, do these things. I once went to the DMV and it took all day when I only expected it to take all morning. So they were like, gosh, it's okay, just do, luckily there was no meetings that day, so I just did my work in the evening, and then I came in early and stayed late the next day. So I've been lucky to work in environments where they were understanding like that.
Yeah. And that's a gift, too, to just be able to have that flexibility there to kind of, I mean, we're never going to get a perfect balance, but to, kind of do that little swing back and forth a little bit helps, for sure.
Yeah, completely.
Is there a particular film that inspired you, through your life? That basically you saw this film and this, kind of helped set you on your path? I want to be a part of that.
I have two.
Okay.
And they were both kind of why I wanted to be in animation and be an artist and be a storyteller and a writer. First was Nightmare Before Christmas. I saw that when I was super young, and I was just in disbelief that this entire film looked like one man's, unfortunately, he's great. That's not what I'm saying, but it looked like one. Okay, let me start over, please. That's a rabbit hole for negative comments. It was just amazing to see this whole film look like one person's artistic identity. Mm-hmm. You know, nothing else looks like that movie.
Yeah.
And stop motion is just a gift to the world as well. Stop motion is amazing, and not only did they do it, but it looked great, and it was so stylistic.
Yeah.
And the storytelling was so interesting, and obviously as an adult I relate to it very much, and it's the same old thing, you know. And I grew so weary with the sound of spring, you get all that monotony, but also as a kid you still related to it. It's just so interesting. So I loved it for all those things, and it's just so beautiful. But then when Toy Story came out, that's when I realized it was a job. And that's when I wanted to be an animator. So I wanted to be some kind of creative artist or writer with Nightmare Before Christmas, but Toy Story, it was whoa, you can just the stories that you can tell with animation. Yeah. You can tell any story with it, you know? And I feel like we're getting to the point where you can do that with live action, but there's just so much charm in animation.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing. So those two.
And I also feel like one of the gifts of animation is that, especially with characters from Nightmare Before Christmas and Toy Story, it's easier for anybody to feel like a pull, an identifying pull, sympathy for a character, and feel like that character represents them, versus like with live action, you're kind of, the actor or actress looks the way they look, and so you may not, like, you might sympathize with the character, but you may not necessarily identify with the character in the same way that you might have with, like, a, you know, animated character.
Oh, that's completely true. Although, with casting, you can look for a type. But yeah, you can definitely, like, I don't know, like, so much love goes into every frame, into every puppet, into every piece of fabric. And everything is thought out over and over and over again. Just so much love goes into it. And live action is the same. A lot of love goes into those as well. But you have to be so intentional with animation so that you don't waste resources. Because you can't go always go back and take a, you know, a... No, never mind. Go on. Try not to go down rabbit holes.
If you had a particular book that was a huge influence for yourself.
I didn't read a lot of books when I was little. I read them to get the book points. to get free things at the Scholastic Book Fair. But I usually guessed on the test to, like, try to cheat it because I didn't want to read. I like watching things more than I liked reading.
It can be a recent book, too. It doesn't have to be from childhood either.
Totally, totally. Yeah. In saying that, because I'll start a lot of books, but then I get bored really quickly. And I want to force myself to finish it, but I also don't want to waste my time if I'm not feeling a story. Mm-hmm. But the books that I could read in one sitting are any of the Harry Potters, as well as Howl's Moving Castle. I can read Howl's Moving Castle multiple times. I love it so much. And, of course, Lord of the Rings. Lord of the Rings is so good. But Howl's Moving Castle is probably the book that I love the most.
And what about it do you love? What is it that draws you?
It's just such a fantastical world, you know. And I love the movie, but the book, just to kind of hear the internal monologues, you know, and I don't know, I just find it so fascinating that you could capture so many things, like hope and despair on a page, and Harry Potter did this really well. A lot of authors do this so well, but, like, these are the ones that connected with me. I like the fantasy world of things that couldn't possibly happen here, because our world's kind of boring, you know. Sometimes our world's also quite wonderful too.
I definitely relate on the Harry Potter books. It's like, for me, it's not Christmas until, like, at the beginning of November, I start rereading the Harry Potter series, and then it's Harry Potter on DVD loop all 2 months. Mm-hmm. And my husband's just like, "Oh God, this again."
Yeah. Oh, I'd like to say a graphic novel as well.
Sure.
I love graphic novels because, like, you got get the picture with it. Mm-hmm. I usually read it really super fast and only read the words. And then I go back and read it with the pictures. It's always like a race for me. I don't know why. But I really love Raina Telgemeier's books, like Drama and Sisters and the most recent one, Ghosts.
Oh.
She has a very simple style that is very unique to her, mm-hmm. and her storytelling is very clear. Oh my God, I have more actually, because I also really love Pajmita by Nidhi Chinnani, it's amazing. And the stories that you can tell with graphic novels, to go on another, they're so personal. They can be so personal, and it's just the author doing the writing and the comic art, and I feel like that's so special, because while animation is so special because of the product that it is, of a very collaborative creative process, mm-hmm. on the flip side you have the very personal process where you get to see all of a creator on the page.
Yeah.
So they both have their merits, and they're both amazing, and I love them both.
I love it.
Yeah.
I absolutely agree, and it feels like a very, it feels like they're letting you in on a secret almost. It feels so intimate because you are seeing the creator on the page.
Yeah, that's exactly. Fantastic. Yeah, and the reason I got into autobio comics was Lucy uh-huh. Nisley and her first book, French Milk. Uh-huh. It was about her journey to, her and her mom took a trip to Paris. She was graduating college, and her mom, I think, was also graduating or, like, retiring. Something, it was two big deals for both okay. of the women. And so they went to France just for a mother-daughter trip. And so she was kind of processing her feelings about leaving college mm-hmm. and her mom, and processing her changing relationship with her mom, because she was now out of college and an adult, and now she has to kind of redefine her relationship with her mom, who is also an adult.
Yeah.
You know, so it was very interesting, and I just fell in love with it. And I'm like, so that's my goal with comics, is to get to the point where I can do, like, travelogues that are external in uh-huh. going to places, as well as internal, about processing your feelings about being in those places and where you are in life.
That's beautiful.
Yeah. So my little diary comics are like baby steps towards that, ultimately. But yeah, she's made really great books since then as well. That was like, it meandered a lot, but I loved it. Edit that out. Don't put that. That's just for okay, you.
Just
it's
the
great.
Last line. Okay. I can't wait to pick it up and read it.
Yeah.
Oh my
I'm
gosh.
So sorry. I just named like 5 books. So.
No, don't be sorry. This is awesome.
Yeah. I feel like people are made up of so many things.
Absolutely.
It's really hard to like nail it down to one. Like, you are all the people you meet, and you are all the things you read and see. Mm-hmm. And you don't take everything, obviously, but you take what you're like, I like that.
Yeah.
Go put that in my brain and catalog that.
Absolutely. And I was wondering if you had any last advice for other creators who are trying to do the balance between day job and following their passions, and also just some words of encouragement, like, if for the people who are still working toward that, where they hope to be.
I want to steal your answer from my podcast.
You absolutely
no,
can.
I won't. I won't. That's cheating. Can. That's cheating. But you can go listen to that podcast and get it for yourself too. She's full of good. You're really full of great advice.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. I'm still trying to figure it out. Mm-hmm. And I don't always do it gracefully. And I feel like that probably goes for most people. But it's going to be a long journey. So you have to figure out what success means to you. And I don't think... Well, for myself, I won't speak for other people, but for myself, it's not working for a specific company. Mm-hmm. It's doing a specific craft. I want to tell stories. I want to contribute to a creative process, as well as do my own thing. And ultimately, to distill it even further, be a storyteller, right? And contribute yeah. to that process. So whatever I can do to do that and put goodness into the world... Like, if I left the industry tomorrow, I would still be doing something that would put good into the world mm-hmm. and probably using storytelling as a tool to do that. But right now, I want to do it in animation. I probably always want to be in animation. but that's my version of success. And mm-hmm. so I know that to filter out all my other experiences, like, am I hitting that goal? Then yeah. I'm good, and I can have some, like, self-worth and self-respect no matter where I am, whether it's good or bad. Because, you know, a career is, in this industry at least, and it seems like most industries nowadays, is that you're piecing together your career. Mm-hmm. You'll go from job to job.
For sure.
And you will have hiatuses. You might have some longer ones than others, and it will not look like anyone else's career or journey. And you have to remember not to compare. But in terms of continuing on and having motivation to stay on your path, I think, and what I tell myself, is that if you hit something hard enough and long enough, it'll eventually happen. Mm-hmm. So, like, I'm writing, which is good because I want to be a writer.
Yeah.
You have to be doing the thing you want to do to prepare yourself for when opportunity knocks. You have to prepare yourself to be lucky. Because if you're doing the thing you want to do and you're putting yourself out there, and asking for people to, like, give you advice or to give a script to read, like, mm-hmm. people will remember you, especially if you made them feel good or, you know, is that a problematic sentence? If you made them feel good? Let me specify. they'll remember you if you were kind, if you made them feel good after your interaction. Like, people will generally remember you, especially if you keep in touch respectfully. And it'll eventually happen for you. And of course, you have to do your own thing. Because I think that does, you have to put the action to it. Oh, this is so meandering. I'm so sorry.
You're doing great.
Okay. Do the thing you want to do, no matter if some gatekeeper is allowing you to do it or not. Yeah. I leave it there.
I love it. Yeah. Thank you so much for your time, Cassie.
Yeah, thank you so much. You're a great host. I'm so happy.
Oh, I'm so happy that you're here and I got to be on your podcast.
Yeah,
and
you're on my podcast. Yay! We have marked each other's projects.
Yes.
We collabed.
More collaborations to come.
Yes, exactly.
Right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You can help Midnight Donatellos. Support our podcast with a small monthly donation to keep our community going and growing. Go to anchor.fm/midnight-donatellos/support. Thank you. Midnight Donatellos is written and produced by Kate Morin. Audio recording engineering by Scott Knudsen. Additional production by Val Patron. Theme music by Mike Barnett. This is a Wild Hunt Studios production.